Wesley Cantrell stops by for podcast number 2 with Simple Biz 360. We're so honored to have him here as this is part of our Career Corner installment. And today, Wesley's going to be illuminating sales as a profession. So if you thought that sales is an occupation of desperation, in other words, you can't get another job, so you just fall back to sales. Well, today, we're going to do our best to present sales as a profession of aspiration. Stick with us. Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning into the Simple Biz 360 podcast. This is episode 200, landmark episode, and I am so privileged today to have a special guest on, Wesley Cantrell. Wesley, say hello to everybody, and thanks for being on, sir.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. It sure is good to see you again, and I'm delighted to join Jeff again on Simple Biz 360. It's a great opportunity and privilege for me. I'm down here in Atlanta, Georgia, living in a senior living facility, but that does portray my age. I'm not nearly as young as I look. So you can make your bets on how old I am if you'd like to, or I'll tell you, whatever is your pleasure. But I'm a professional grandfather. I've got 22 grandchildren and 37 great-grandchildren, and they are the pride and joy of my life. And for this work today that we're going to be doing about the profession of salesmanship and being a salesman, I'm hoping that many of my grandchildren will join in, that we could actually stock and staff a large company with just my grandchildren. Can you imagine that? What a pleasure that would be.
How fun.
So I'm having a great time in this portion of my life, and the Lord has blessed me with good health, and I'm able to travel and able to go in just about anywhere I want to go. And that's a great privilege, and the opportunity like this knocks every once in a while when I have an opportunity to speak and voice my concerns and thoughts to some good audience like Jeff generates here. And I'm delighted to be with you today, Jeff. And let's give it a go.
Well, Wes, thank you so much. It really is a true privilege. And, you know, we hope that we hope to really have a lot of good content on this show that is timeless and spends, you know, goes out there for many, many decades and is useful. Folks, if why is this so special to me? Well, this is really where it all began. Wes was the president of Lanier Business Products when I started my business career after college in New York City. And in 1984, August, to be particular. And Wes was the president at that time, soon became the CEO a few years later. And Wes has led organizations that have the Lanier Business Products kind of evolved and mushroomed into a lot of different things through acquisitions and mergers, and ended up at one point being the CEO of Ricoh Copiers and Lanier Worldwide, 8,000 employees, in addition to his four kids and 22 grandkids, and now, of course, 37 great-grandchildren. So it is, it's really neat to be able to dip back to where it all began. And the reason Wes is on this episode, we had him on earlier. It was a wonderful chat with him to catch up. But the Lanier Business Products model that existed for many, many decades was a sales-driven model. But it was not an unprofessional sales-driven model. It was a professional sales model, and they taught us things that we'll never forget and many of us use to this day. So that is going to be kind of the content of the show. For those of you who are first-time followers, you might be catching this on the YouTube experience or the Rumble video experience, or we're not on IGTV in this episode because it's too long, but we are also on Gab TV for shorter episodes, and then we're on 28 listening platforms. So we hope we're going to create a nice listening experience if you're listening in to both of us. But if you're watching the YouTube experience, we'd love a subscription to the channel. We'd love a follow if you're listening. And we're going to have lots of fun and good information here. So why did I ask you to be on, Wes? What was the reason for this? Is that you and I had a chat, and we really settled in on the fact that sales is a profession, and it has its own methodology to it or sets of methodologies. It has its own, wording, its own phrases, its own skill sets. And it's really not something that I think so many people, you know, unfortunately may view it as like a fallback to the job you didn't get that you wanted out of college. And, oh, well, I'll be a salesperson. You know, I think there's some people that may think that, but, certainly not everyone. So I'm going to throw out a number of questions to you, and we'd love to hear your responses to it. And, just folks, we're encouraging, educating, enlightening everyone who's listening for years to come to recognize and embrace sales as a professional capacity. And that's really what we're trying to establish here today. And I know there's a lot of professionals and associates that feel the same way we both do, Wes. So we're just curious, in your career, when did the reality hit you, Wes, that sales was a profession and it wasn't just a, another occupation?
Well, Jeff, you probably remember that I started my career with Lanier as a technician, and I was out repairing copiers and dictating machines. And I saw in that relationship just how easy sales could be when you were inside the business and you understood what was going on and what the customer's needs were. And all you did was show up with an answer. Now, as a technician, they were always glad to see me because I was going to repair some problem that they had.
Sure.
As a sales rep, sales reps have a hard time getting in to see the right person because they're defensive. They have gatekeepers out front that are taught to keep you out so that you can't get in. And so that can cause you to get into a negative connotation if you're not careful. But I began to see early on the fact that selling was a wonderful profession. And I had been married just for a short period of time, and we were starting to have babies. And we had two babies, and I was working on commission. And I began to see that the more sales that I produced, the better life was. We had money to spend. We could buy the things that we needed for the children. And I began to see what a wonderful job it was, because I began to see myself just like I did as a technician, a problem solver for the customer. As I went in as a technician, the customer had a product that wasn't working, and I was to get it back in order for it. In the case of the sales rep, the customer has a problem he doesn't know about. My job is to eliminate that problem, help him to see it, and show him the answer to that problem, which, of course, would include one of my products. And so it makes selling a lot more desirable profession, because you are actually enhancing the business opportunity of the people that you're selling to.
Sure.
And you see yourself as a problem solver, not just somebody who's in there to talk them into a quick sale so you can get the money. This, I think, was unique in the philosophy of Lanier, is that once we taught all of our salespeople, and there are people, of course, who will naturally gravitate toward all kinds of quick fix types of things, quick fixes in terms of getting an order real fast, or misrepresenting things to the customer to get them to buy. And there are people who kind of fall into that trap. I think what Jeff is pointing out is that Lanier, we pointed everybody to a very professional attitude of a sales rep that was honest, had high integrity, worked hard, understood the plan, understood how the whole system worked, and it was a model, by the way, that many of our men and women who have left the company and gone on to other jobs are still using in their lives, because it gives them a model of productivity,
a
great scheduling of activities that will produce good results. It's a pattern for any business.
Absolutely.
And it's a wonderful thing that we learned from Lanier. What a great legacy. And it's our job today, Jeff and I, to kind of helpfully pass that along to all of those who are watching and would be interested in adopting sales as a professional career.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. So here you're at this juncture as a young man. You're a problem solver. You're going in there on service calls. There's equipment that's malfunctioning, not working correctly, or people don't know how to operate it. So you're going in there as a problem solver. You've also got this ability to get some commission on some, aftermarket sales and things. And all of a sudden, you realize that, sales is a problem-solving profession. And I would say that's the first, that's really, if you kind of look at a cornerstone of sales, I mean, isn't that really the essence of what we're trying to go in there? And if our products and services don't work, don't help to solve a problem they currently have, then we really have no business trying to sell it to them. But if it does help them, now we're in this mode as a problem solver. And because of that, it becomes, I hope listeners and viewers can start to see, and if there's young people watching this, or they maybe, you know, you could pass it on to young people, because they can begin to see sales is a profession of aspiration, not desperation. So we're going to kind of use that as the theme. Problem solving is really the cornerstone of this, right? And everything else falls into place. So Wes, speak to character. Character in the selling profession is important to you as a young man. It's been important to you as a CEO. It's important to you now. Talk about that a little bit, if you could.
Yes, character is extremely important, and it's what we look for in the recruiting process as we are recruiting new sales reps. And we look at various aspects of character. Some of the background check information that we used to get is more difficult to get because the laws have changed so much and closed that down. But we really want to know a background of previous behaviors, which we predict future behaviors. Character, of course, if you ask the most important aspect of the whole thing, that is it. And Chick-fil-A, founded here in Atlanta by Truett Cathy, was a good friend of mine. And in talking to Truett one day about the quality of the men and women he was hiring, he said to me, character is the single most important ingredient. And he pointed out in the scriptures that in the biblical characters that are loaded there, like pastors or deacons or elders, where they list the qualities of them, most of the qualities they list as requirements are character related. So interestingly, we've got a biblical model there of the need for character. So as the government clamps down on their restrictions on what background information you can get, there's still always a way to get the information that you need. And it's so important that we go the extra mile in determining the character of the people that we're going to hire.
Yeah.
If you don't, it's you to pay bitterly for it in the future.
Yeah.
And I found my wife, by the way, she used to go with me on dinner interviews of new prospects. She had great instincts about the character of people, almost amazingly so, what she would see and predict to me. I guess what I'm kind of saying is, you guys out there, if you've got a good wife, or your wives, if you've got a good husband, take them with you when you do your interviews, and you may find out something you just totally missed. And women, of course, they have this. I've always said women have like a sixth sense about senses, things that just go right over my head. And that's why I miss my wife so much, because she was so, so good at that. She made a great contribution to Lanier. And many of the people at Lanier will even remember that they may have gotten promotions based on the fact that Bernadine kind of singled them out in some media or something and told me, boy, you need to do something. I remember particularly Vera Author, who became our human resources leader. And Bernadine was the one who said, you got to put Vera in the job. And we did. And she was a huge success and so helpful to me in that particular job. So character is what it's all based on, and you'll never build a great company without a lot of people there that have a high degree of character.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It's kind of funny. I with Oxford Industries, it took me 9 interviews to get my job. About 5 months, and my 7th interview was actually with the vice president of sales and his wife at a dinner, so she could Wes's advice there is very, very appropriate. Now let's dip back to Truett Cathy for a second. What's interesting, I was just at a national conference not too long ago, and the speaker was addressing the attrition rate in the fast food industry, and where, you know, you have a lot of rates, there's some at 87%, some higher. But I believe the percentage at Chick-fil-A was either 13 or 17%. So the reason I bring that up is that it is a very, very low attrition rate. And what a lot of sales organizations or CEOs or C-suite personnel, sales managers, sales supervisors miss is you can really do yourself a lot of favors in the interviewing process by asking the right questions, putting the person in the right situation. And here's what I'm leading up to. Like Truett Cathy, he could, you know, most likely, you know, detect where there was high character and low character, and that was part of the equation to hire people. So it certainly is important, but it also comes into play when you look at motivation versus skill. I know that Lanier taught us that, you know, there's no way you could give somebody, or you could, as a sales manager or sales supervisor, create motivation. You had to get the people who fit a formula of 70% will, 30% skill. You could always give them product knowledge. You could always give them, you know, a marketplace knowledge, but you couldn't make that person, you know, get out of bed in the morning with a pep in their step and want to come into the office and do the job. And so speak a little bit about, in addition to character in the hiring process, what about the hiring process? What advice can you give to companies who want to get the best sales professional in that capacity?
Well, obviously, as we've been saying there, you start with character, but then there is a, in the interviewing process, you'll pick up an ability on the part of the desirable rep to respond attractively to all questions and not to give you blunt or particularly not critical answers to your questions. I remember once I was interviewing in Germany, a man who was going to manage our German business. And in the interview process, I asked him a question and he said back to me, "Mr. Cantrell, here's the question you should have asked me." Now, just imagine that. Do you think that guy got the job? So it's kind of, and to me, it was very, in terms of what I would say, Germanic characters. They tend to be pretty direct and sure they're right. Many of them do. That's not fair to cull them all with the same swab, but he was certainly a representative of that. Now, in the I think in the questions and answers where you ask them different questions, just how they choose to answer and whether they give you just a short one word or a no comment answer or things like that, you know, all are attributes that you'd be looking at very, very carefully. But the biggest thing you're looking for is the indication that they have character. And one of the key things that you might test is their ability to stand alone. A person with real high character will, even in the face of adversity, will still stand for his or her beliefs. And I used to ask the question, has there ever been a time in your life where something really controversial happened and you had to take a stand, which was not real popular with the crowd? It's not the stand that they all want, but you did that. And if you have an experience like that, could you tell me about it? Well, sometimes people would say, well, I don't remember anything like that. But in some cases, you would get a really unusual answer about something that happened in school or college or in a previous job where everybody was against this thing. And this one guy took a stand. What a beautiful picture of character when somebody is willing to stand alone. And, you know, life in general is going to be confronted with standing alone. Imagine right now sending your kids to school and all that they're going to be confronted with. And can you equip them to stand alone in the deluge of all kinds of things you're going to be hearing in school or suggestions of what they do? How in the world do you as a parent handle that? Well, that's off this subject, of course, but probably one that many of you are interested in. And is there an answer to that? Can you teach a child to stand alone? And can you help them, give them some guardrails to help them stand alone in this crazy, cruel world that we're in today? And the answer is yes, you can do that. And a good sales rep, of course, has to do that because inevitably there are going to be difficulties. Many companies train your gatekeepers, that is the people that sit at the desk when you walk in, to get rid of sales reps. And I remember making a call in California once where the guy said, "Are you a sales rep?" And I said, "Well, not today. I haven't sold anything yet." So, but he gave me a dirty look, and his job was to get rid of me. And so we used all types of clever approaches to get around that. But in this day and age, I think we have so much good information available that if you were making a, what we would call in the business, a cold call, and you haven't been in this business before, but you have the ability to learn from public information, a lot of information about the companies that you're working with. And for example, if you can determine the strategic purpose of the company and you make a call on that company and you say, I'm here to Mr. Cantrell, your CEO is very concerned about customer satisfaction. I have a discovery, a great secret I want to share with him, and you're going to get in because you've actually focused in on a key need in that business that is critical to the CEO. That's what I would do if I was selling today. Maybe I should go back in the field. it's an interesting thought because I think it just all this plethora of information that's available and how well equipped you could be. I think what this begs is to those of you who are sales reps out there, before you make a call, do your research, read and study and know that company, and you will find out from that what hot spots you can touch that are going to really fill their needs, and you will be a problem solver for that company. And the great thing about that is when you come up at the front door, they say, oh, there's Wes Cantrell. Come on in, Wes. We're so glad to see you. Now, that's unusual when you make some calls and the guy said, all right, if you're a salesman, we shot the last five salesmen to walk through the store. I've actually had that said to me, too.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, you get a lot. In the years, you get a lot of things said back to us when we make our sales calls. Well, now I appreciate that. And you know, you fell back to the cornerstone again, problem solving. And yes, that great research. It's an extension of character. You're trying to uncover the problems. And now, you know, you can be a much more effective problem solver by having that information in your bag before you, in your briefcase or backpack before you go in. So, you know, that also in young people, anybody listening to this, that's, you know, scratching their, rubbing their chin thinking, is this really the profession for me? Is this where I want to go? Well, think about this. You know, character breeds character, and good character breeds more good character. So, you know, what we found is the more you have good people of high standing character in the office, in the employ of the company, the more that rubs off. It doesn't necessarily rub off the other way. So it is very essential. And then I think what it does, Wes, is the next point I'd like to highlight is this profession, it's necessarily getting us involved in exercising our human relations skills muscles. And if you ever wanted to know or ask yourself as a young man, young woman, hey, could I be more successful later in my career by going into sales in the beginning part of my career? Well, I would argue, and I'd love your take on it, Wes, I would argue that absolutely, because you are going to learn more about interacting with humans and that human relations, those human relations principles, than if you weren't in sales. Speak to that if you could, Wes. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree. It's extremely important. And in fact, when we were acquired by the Harris Corporation, their big motivation was to add sales and marketing function to their business. They were an engineering company. And so they acquired us. We became part of them and we began to integrate into their business. And what we found immediately is that their thought process was that their engineers were so smart that they built a product that was so good, they did not need a sales force to sell it. And you can imagine what kind of results that produced. It meant that they brought to market some really bad products, some type of cases that were and it would take an unbelievable salesman to sell it. And so what we found at Harris was really a wake-up call of why selling is so important, because they were an organization that didn't have sales, and they looked at us, they used the word hype, that you guys, because we spoke in colorful language about our products, and we used good words to describe it, and their word was hype, that was hype. Puffing and building up something that was not really true. To me, what that means is that every great company has to have a strong sales and marketing force, because it can come up with the best products in the world and they'll just sit there and never get sold. And some of the companies that we acquired were like that. They had great products and we were able to take their product and sell them where they weren't very successful previously. So to go into that profession will add to your portfolio and will give you a great, great resume for the future and promotability. Because at Lanier, you know, to get promoted at Lanier, if you didn't have a sales background, was virtually impossible because sales was such an integral part of everything we did.
Yeah.
And if you didn't have an appreciation or understanding for it, you would not be looked on very favorably for promotion because we didn't think that you would push and keep the plan for rapid growth and expansion going.
Yeah.
And so that would be my idea about adding sales to your portfolio and really having experience and good results to back it up. And also the ability to speak and appreciate the language and not just to exaggerate things, but to give really good factual background information. One of the things we learn in selling is that when you're presenting a product, it really helps to have a story, a real story that illustrates how the product is used and its effectiveness. You've got such a story actual from real use or from history. Also, the ability in your introduction and making contacts about the product to have references that would be favorable to the prospect and his understanding, to open his understanding.
Yeah.
Stories of how things work are always great and well received.
Yeah.
And Jesus spoke with parables, which is stories. He used those to illustrate his point. And parables in business, if you want to call them that,
sure.
Illustrative stories. And my favorite character was Winston Churchill, and I learned a lot of his stories. I was just in London last week, by the way, and I had a wonderful time. I got to sit behind his desk, and he made a picture of me there. I was making pretend like I was Winston Churchill winning World War II, you know. And it just brought back a lot of wonderful memories. But his speaking ability and his ability to put together great phrases and encapsulating what was going on, just absolutely off the charts.
And
always a great blessing to me to read about him.
Well, and
kids gave me two little books while we were there. We had Father's Day while I was in London, by the way. Great way to spend Father's Day.
Absolutely.
They gave me two little books, two little handbooks that had a lot of Winston Churchill's quotes in them. And, of course, there are hundreds of them.
Yeah.
I would recommend, by the way, to anybody in business that you get those books and read them, because if you'd like to have some heavy duty material to entertain, but also to illustrate points, there's a lot of stuff in there that would help you with that.
Well, very, very good. No, I appreciate you sharing that. And, you know, you dipped back into something that became a staple in the Lanier Business Products model. And it's something that many of us hold near and dear today and we take with us. And that's evidence defeats disbelief. So when Wes is speaking about stories that illustrate, you know, how this worked, how the problem was solved, you know, we use demonstrations, examples, facts, exhibits, analogies, testimonials, or statistics to make sure that that person across the other side of the desk understood the why, you know, why, how, you know, and we could explain that much easier. And folks, those in a professional selling, you know, environment, those are some of the things you take away with you and that catapult you into your later years of leadership. And really, I want to dip back and I want to go visit the concept of leadership. You know, I don't know if you remember this, Wes, but it was right on the first chapter of our training manual when we got into the Lanier fold. It was a quote by President Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, and it was a definition of leadership according to Dwight Eisenhower. And his definition, which I've never forgotten to this day, is leadership is the ability to get someone to do what you want them to do because they want to do it. So just think about what Wes said before, this eloquence of mastering the language and being articulate and using examples and stories to make sure that people understand in an integrity-driven, character, you know, driven environment how things work. But you also get to groom and start building your really working out in the leadership gym as you, you know, start going through sales capacity. So when you think about leadership, Wes, how did sales aid and assist you in your eventual leadership capacities?
Well, of course, there's a lot of selling in leadership jobs. You have to lead all of your people. And if you're going to form a vision for the company that everybody adheres to, it requires a lot of leadership and strong influencing to do that. Because if you're not going to have everybody on board when you've got when you're really announcing a new strategic purpose, you're kidding yourself. You're not going to get anywhere. And for example, when we put together Harris, 3M copiers, and Lanier into one company, and I became the CEO. So at the time I became CEO, I had a group of people from Harris Corporation who were all, you know, very engineering, numbers-oriented guys. I had a group of people from 3M who were entitlement-oriented. At 3M, they really focused on the companies, really provided a lot of benefits, and that's what they focused on. And I would say there were entitlement benefits. And then you had Lanier, which was a sales organization, yeah, pure, all up and down. And I had these three groups of people together, and we're going to talk about the corporate purpose of our company. And one of the decisions that I made in that case, Jeff, is instead of hiring a professional facilitator to come in and lead us in establishing that, I decided to do it myself. I thought I had these three groups of people, the Harris people who came from Harris, the 3M people who came from Europe and Latin America, and some from the United States, but from all over. And, of course, I had the old Lanier people, which I knew. And I wanted to really build I wanted to cement my relationship to them as the CEO of this organization with a strategic purpose, which was extremely important to me. And we got it to be extremely important to them through discussions around, and just by looking at facts about our companies, the three companies that we represented and the backgrounds of them. And that's where we came up with that Lanier would be the best in customer satisfaction, to focus on being the best in customer satisfaction. And I tell you, when it came up in that meeting room and we asked about it, they coalesced around that so beautifully. I just felt so great because everybody agreed that's what we wanted to be. Not the best in engineering, not the best in sales, but the best in customer satisfaction.
Yeah.
And you know, a great thing about that is when your sales force is hired on customer satisfaction, if you get these guys who are a little bit devious in their ideas about how to sell and just sure, separate the company from the customer from his money, if you focus on customer satisfaction, that really negates that objective right away, because they realize if they're going to do something that makes the customer unhappy, then we're not going to be happy with, yeah, their performance. And so it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I think the leadership involved in getting that on the right path was extremely important to me. And of course, we were very successful with that objective, because at the time we started, our customer satisfaction was at 47%. And we studied our competitors like Xerox, and theirs was 47% also. That gave us good information because we knew they'd be easy to knock off in that particular relationship. And I kind of liked that. Because, as you might have guessed, sure, I'm very competitive.
Sure.
And we were very competitive, and we did not like our competitors. The old quote was, they're the people who take the bread off your table and the shoes off your baby's feet. And so we didn't like them at all. But we did learn a lot about how to make the customers happy. And by the time I retired, the customer satisfaction was up to 92%. And the 2 years after I retired, we won the customer satisfaction J.D. Power for being the best in customer satisfaction in both years.
Yeah.
2 years after I retired. Guys at Lanier called me and they said, Wes, hey, tell you this, we had to wait until you got out of here to win this award. But they knew, of course, it was near and dear to my heart.
You did the buildup. Yeah. Yeah.
And so the great thing about a singular purpose like that is it really helps so much, sure, in the whole selection process, because if they see how committed you are to it, they realize if your company is really totally committed to customer satisfaction, if they do something that makes that customer unhappy, they realize they're not going to be promoted.
Sure.
You know, maybe,
sure,
might even lose their jobs. Every, sure, time we did that.
Well, and you're, you. Yeah, oh, I know. I think you know what your great story, and you're really emphasizing, you know, how again, through this model of going through professional selling early on in your career, it's really grooming leadership for tomorrow. And so, yeah, again, folks, you know, this, you know, desperation or aspiration, you know, think of the things embedded into it. A good name, Now, when you think about the high priority that you put on a good name and what a lot of other people just kick around like a sandlot football, right? And it's just, hey, you know what? You know, what's a good name? Well, I tell you what, the world ends up being a pretty small place when you start staying in one industry and you move from company to company in an industry. You know, a good name means a lot more than you think. Could you speak to that a little bit, Wes? How important is a good name in the industry, in the marketplace?
Well, it's far reaching when you start studying all that you do within a company to produce a good name. It's amazing how deep you have to go. When the customer relates within your business, who does he talk to? And does he get a quick answer? Is he put on hold? There are all kinds of answers, things like that, that you look into that just are so aggravating in business today, like trying to get in touch with an actual, honest to goodness, alive human being
to answer
a question for you. It's so difficult today.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would say that if you just had a real person that answered your phone, and they gave you good answers, that would improve your customer satisfaction remarkably. There's one company that I do a good bit of business with called American Express. And one thing I like about American Express is they have the typical maze that you go through to get through to a real live person.
Sure.
But one or two clicks, they give you a real live person.
You get
and then
one.
They really deal with your needs. And I like that. So I'm giving them high marks. If there are any American Express executives that happen to watch this, you can use me in your commercials if you'd like, a little bit small fee, but it's important to do that. We got into looking at all of our things that we did with the customers, really evaluating every conversation with the customer, and the fact that you didn't pass people along, but that you personally took responsibility for getting them an answer. There are a lot of, when you really delve into the depth of customer satisfaction, there's so many things that you look at. And I remember we really studied in the copier business, what does it make to make a customer happy? And what is the key thing? And I ask a lot of customers, I made a lot of calls with sales reps. And when I was with the big, the high ranking people at the business, I'd say, well, tell me, what is the most important thing? Take me to people who actually use the product. I want to know what they think, because the executives sometimes have heard something and boiled up through the inside information of the company, but they may not know exactly what is wrong or what the customer would like.
Yeah.
What we found out is that with copiers, what people really wanted was a really good, sharp, black on white copy. They wanted it to be clearly defined, no background fuzziness or anything. Well, in order to do that with a copier, you had to spend extra money each time you serviced the machine to be sure the drum was in top-notch condition. In some cases, you had to change the drum. Most expensive part in the copier.
Yeah.
And we gave the salesman the authority to change, service people to change and upgrade those drums if it didn't come up to spec without checking with us or anything. They could just do it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get myself a drink of water here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll join you. That looks like nice pink water.
It is. That's some kind of water that's got an electrolyte.
Here you go.
Supposed to make me feel good. Give me more energy.
I love it. My grandkids use it all the time when they're out, you know, sweating and, you know, running around, jumping around. Yeah, it helps out. But so absolutely. Well, listen, I think you know, you're really saying some things that. I just keep going back to this, you know, epicenter, this cornerstone of problem solving. I mean, you're really, you're sitting there saying, hey, customer satisfaction, you know, there's a lot of different metrics to make the customer happy. But when it really comes down to it, you know, there's some simple things you can do at the company level, just like you suggested, giving the authority to the service technicians to go out and do what they had to do without approval. You know, they knew what they needed to do to get somebody.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's I love that fact. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, we held the mug up earlier and it's, you know, been in our thumbnail, the truth mug, right? So there you go. You know, simple biz, this is an important part of what we talk about when we try to create a better customer experience. It's one of the tenets, and integrity is huge. evangelizing truth. This is another thing that if you're in a professional selling organization, they will not tell you and they will not teach you to go out there and just say whatever you need to say to get the deal. They're going to tell you to go out there, use evidence that defeats disbelief, use those seven elements of proof to go out and evangelize truth. Speak if you could, a little bit about evangelizing truth in a sales capacity.
Well, it's I think it starts with the core of really believing that within the company and making that a part of how the salespeople think, and then to give them dramatic abilities to demonstrate the truth to the customer in a way that is very remarkable. And one of the most effective ways I think we found, Jeff, is what we would call the product demo. And product demos were extremely important in Lanier. You remember that when you went to school, we taught you how to give a demo. That's a way to show the customer how to use the product that applies directly to how he or she would use the product. And so a product demo then is a great opportunity to dramatize the product in use for the customer. I've seen some wonderful, unbelievable performances from sales reps who really were good at this, almost like a Broadway performance. You know, you say, this is really good stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You say, if I needed one of these things, I'd buy it myself.
Yeah, for sure.
And so the other thing about it is that sometimes I remember once I was selling a copier. And I got in to see this guy, and I said, I'd like to show you this copy. He said, oh, I don't want to disappoint you, Mr. Cantrell, but I've already seen that copy. And I said to him, well, all due respect, sir, you haven't really seen it until I show it to you. And every good and every good rep, that's the way he or she feels, is that, you know, I can dramatize things. I can make connections to your actual needs that you haven't thought of. And so in the demo, you know, you're giving them real live illustrations of how you would use this product. And it just makes the whole thing come alive. And it takes away the ability to misrepresent the product to some degree, but adds to it an enhancement thing, almost an entertainment part of the presentation, which I came to really enjoy, because you can watch the prospect as you're giving this dramatic presentation of the product. And it became such a wonderful thing. It actually was fun. Mm-hmm. It was almost like, I use the illustration of the Broadway act. It's almost like, you know, putting on a performance and watching the person react to it. And the natural reaction is to say, okay, I want this. How do we get started? And, you know, the old adage, you have the fans that press hard, there are three copies, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
The old clothes.
Wear so many different clothes. But yeah, no, it's a fun one. press hard. Well, you know, again, you're kind of you're helping paint this picture that in a professional selling capacity, to be a true problem solver, to have a good name, to exercise and demonstrate good character, is when you demonstrate product, a lot of times it takes the you know, if you were ever inclined to lie, just demonstrating the product can remove the inclination for a lie. But you know, but I mean, what it does in a professional capacity, if you're taught like we were in Lanier, this is the message to board of directors out there, and you know, future chairman of the boards that are looking at hiring a leader for their team. When you dip into the pool of professional salespeople who have gone through these ranks and who have been evangelists of truth, you can start to see the picture. You're getting people, and again, the young people listening to this, some of your grandchildren and great-grandchildren perhaps. You know, when you start really polishing and exercising those muscles of all those different things, problem-solving, character, good name, good customer satisfaction, evangelizing truth, you know, you're developing leadership, human relations skills, you're now starting to really create a very strong leader of tomorrow. And you're really, you know, sales, you know, is an avenue that professional sales, an avenue that can equip today's worker for, you know, that type of calling 2 decades, 3 decades down the road. And that's where you make your income that sets your family up. That's where you make a big impact. That's where you can really do things in a large way. And Wes, I mean, not many of us get the opportunity to lead a group of 8,000 people, but, you know, you got there and you did it because you went to the gym and you flexed all these muscles and you combined them. And you know, not to mention, let's talk about your ability to use the human language. I think we shared this when we talked a few weeks ago that, you know, I think I read a statistic one time, Wes, where it said only 7% of current CEOs have the ability to public speak or have a background in public speaking. So I know I started public speaking early on in my career, late 80s, as I went to colleges and stuff. I'd meet with the marketing clubs and I started getting involved because I wanted to be familiar with this. I wanted to, you know, understand this. Speak to that a little bit. How well equipped does this profession of selling, you know, prepare someone for that ability to articulate in front of large audiences?
Well, you're learning how to make a presentation under what you would probably think of as a great deal of pressure. Mm-hmm. People there don't know what you're talking about. They probably have natural sales resistance. They probably say, well, this guy's here to sell us. And so his job is to convince us he's right. And we may want to pick it apart a little bit and give him a hard ride on that. Sometimes they do that, which is fine.
Yeah.
Because objections are just a natural way of closing a sale, you know. And in selling and sales training, we taught people to anticipate objections, to welcome objections, and to turn them into buying reasons. And if you can do that, in most cases you can, a good sales rep can be extremely, extremely successful. So those are some of the great attributes of developing a sales ability. But the other thing about it is that as you go up in the career, you're going to have more and more opportunities to speak effectively into people who make policy and who make decisions about the future of your company. Imagine particularly going on Wall Street, you're taking a company public, and all of a sudden, for the first time, you're dealing with the wolves of Wall Street out there, and they're picking apart everything you say. And you've got, you know, 64 MBAs that look at everything you put on paper, and they take it apart. How do you react to that? Do you criticize them or say they're stupid because all they've got is a piece of paper, they've never done a day's work in their lives? No, that's not a good idea. The good idea is to say, okay, in this whole passel of information they're handing along to me, there's some good stuff that I need to know that they have picked out about our company. Find out what that stuff is and use it. And then when you have an opportunity to speak, you really develop your speaking ability, which means, you know, that you're relaxed about it, that you use language that's easy to understand, that your pronunciation of words is difficult. If you're from the South like I am, you know, you may have to learn how to pronounce some words a little differently. I've certainly done that. I like to relax back into my former country boy style from time to time. But I did learn how to maybe articulate the English in a little better way so that you'd be accepted. And some of the words that I would use, you know, maybe more attractively, could be used in speaking. And I developed my speaking ability because the next thing you know is I'm speaking on all kinds of platforms. Sure. And it's kind of important to the company's future. The scariest one of all was in the late 70s. We won some kind of an award for our performance during the recession. If you remember, 1977 was a big recession. That was during the Carter years when we had the illustrious leadership of Jimmy Carter. And we did really, really well. Now, so Sales and Marketing Magazine came down to see me and they wanted to know, how did y'all do so good during this recession? And I said, well, for one thing is we did what we were going to do when we didn't know about the recession. We didn't let the recession stop us. So we introduced new products. We hired new salespeople. We advertised and we went right on just like it was going to be business as usual for us. And in fact, it was business much better than usual. We had a fabulous year. And they wrote this article in Sales Marketing Magazine. It was entitled, "A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Recession," which was to say, these crazy guys down here at Lanier in Atlanta, they were able to beat the recession. And they turned it into, it was good stuff. They had a good time.
Wow.
So then they invited me, Jeff, to come and speak to the New York Sales and Marketing Executives Club. Now, can you imagine that? Wow. I'm in New York City, Sales and Marketing Executive Clubs, and here I am, you know, the country boy from Hiram, Georgia, and I'm going up in the Waldorf Astoria to speak to these people. Did that make me a little nervous? Yes, it did. It made me a little nervous. I worked hard on my speech. I got it nailed down. I took my wife with me so she'd be sitting out there to give me moral encouragement.
Sure.
And I made the speech, and it was a big hit. And in fact, I got invited to give that same speech in San Francisco to sales and marketing execs out there, and to L.A., and I think one other location. I remember traveling a good bit and giving that speech. And why was I doing that? It was just good PR for Lanier.
Yeah.
But it also was setting a platform for the sales forces on those areas to sell into those prospects that would hear me speak. So in a sense, all those talks I was giving were sales pitches.
Yeah.
And they were saying, okay, here's a guy, runs a good company. Look what they did. Look how well they're doing, how well they come up with good new products, and they're selling like crazy, and we should be interested.
Yeah.
And so it kind of paved the way for the sales force to get new prospects and to sell more business. So I thought the idea of being a public speaker, even though I would not recommend that for a living, that being able to do it and do it very effectively is a critical, critical skill. And particularly after you're acquired by somebody else, you have a board of directors, and they don't know you for a sack of salt, and you've got to make presentations to them to get your acquisitions approved and things like that approved. And I found the Harris board was somewhat, they looked at me skeptically because, you know, I was a salesy background and they didn't know if they trusted those or not.
Yeah.
And so when I would go to make a presentation, they asked me some kind of funny questions one time. But one thing I found out, whenever I showed up at a quarterly board meeting, if I showed up with $75 million free cash flow, they gave me a free ride.
That'll help. That will help the board meeting for sure.
It really lubricated the process.
Oh my gosh. Well, I tell you, we appreciate you touching on the, you know, public speaking in that. And really, Wes, what you're really emphasizing is there is an attitude in you that was taught to you through the company of professional skill building, personal skill building. You took it upon yourself to recognize that you want to be, or you can be, you've got the platform to enhance your speaking skills. And I mean, I listen to you today. I mean, folks, I hope you don't mind it. You know, this man is 88 years old. And I don't know, very articulate, Wes. I'm not just saying that because you're my guest, but you're extremely articulate, extremely well understood. And you do a lot of public speaking at churches and to organizations right now as we're talking and doing this podcast. So, you know, you're proof of the pudding that this, you know, a walk down the professional sales capacity lane can lead to an effective speaker. And again, you as, you know, leaders – companies want leaders who can do that. They want personnel who can effectively articulate, get people to do what they want them to do because those people are listening want to do it, right? And there's all these things that are baked into it, but it's this commitment to self-development. And I think you mentioned that you used the word entitlement in conjunction with Harris Corporation back in the 80s. Entitlement, we certainly see a lot of it in society. We unfortunately click and drag, copy and paste a lot of what happens in society into business. So I think there's this, you know, a lot of people think, hey, for instance, I spoke at Ithaca College back in 1988, and the professor at the organizational and behavior classes said there's a spirit and attitude of entitlement here that, hey, back then they were paying $15,000 for tuition for a Division III school, and the parents are basically saying, hey, and the kids are saying, hey, I should get a B for just paying the $15,000, right? I mean, I'm entitled to that B. Well, and, you know, and she was being facetious, but she was saying, look, there's this growing love affair in the world with entitlement. And you know, not that all her students were like that. I don't want to say anything disparagingly about Ithaca University. But, you know, she was pointing it out that I want you to speak to this, Jeff, because there's got to be a commitment to studying and personal skill development, you know, at the personal level. And right, sales, you're living proof of it. So speak to that. I mean, how would you talk about that and encourage somebody young to enter into this personal skill building?
Well, I think you'd have to look at the kind of business that you're going to be involved in to some degree and say you want to be able to speak to really understand and to address the issues that they face. But to me, to developing your speaking ability, there are two or three things that are critical. First and perhaps foremost is your reading habits. What are you reading every day? And how up to date are you on current events? I used to always recommend, and I don't read the Wall Street Journal anymore regularly like I did, but when I was working, it was my go-to paper. Every morning I read it. I took it with me wherever I went. And when I was traveling, I got a Wall Street Journal and I read it from front to back. Now, why was that important? Because there I could find illustrations of things that were real important about how different executives were handling their businesses mm-hmm. and what they were doing to react to situations. And when necessary, I could speak to authoritatively to those issues. You would find great issues of executives who were able to look out over the horizon in the future and see what was coming and adjust their businesses for that. And that skill, that ability to foretaste or foretell and understand the future and how technology is going to shape everything, that is phenomenal. And you've seen some huge, horrible failures, but you've seen some beautiful yeah. breakthroughs in that regard, too.
Yeah.
I can just imagine Steve Jobs going into his board of directors and telling them they're going into the telephone business. Can you imagine that? They're a computer company, and they're going into the telephone business. And he's telling them about he's going to introduce this little thing we call an iPhone. I can imagine the board had a strong reaction to that, and they thought, well, this guy's crazy. We're not in the telephone business. We're in the computer business. And in business, you know, we tend to compartmentalize the business that we're in, and that's an illustration that would kind of, you know,
sure.
Jeff, along those lines, I wonder what happened to Sears and Roebuck. What in the world happened to Sears and Roebuck? Sears and Roebuck had everything in place to yeah. do exactly what Amazon is doing. They had distribution centers. They had a catalog. They had a product line. They had everything identified. Yeah. And somewhere along the line, I can just imagine at some board meeting where somebody said, have you seen what this little upstart Amazon company is doing? And they said, yeah, we've seen that. What do you think is going to happen? Well, we don't think it'll amount to a hill of beans. We don't think they'll ever accomplish anything. And we're not going to try to copy what they... I'll yeah. bet you something like that happened. Because how could Sears have gone right down the proverbial drain as quickly as they did?
Yeah.
And then they go out and they acquire Kmart.
Yeah.
And Kmart is like a sinking ship that wants to save itself by rescuing another sinking ship.
Yeah.
That's yeah. a recipe for disaster. So anyway, what I'm yeah. getting at is a good executive is reading, studying, and developing his ability to visualize the future. And to the degree that he or she can do that, the more effective they're going to be, and to speak to that and to give illustrative illustrations of it. I remember once speaking to our dealer group here in Atlanta, and I was thinking about digital recording machines. And at that time, we had the first digital dictating system. And I was telling them there will be a time in the future when we will have a little product that you carry in your pocket, like our vest pocket secretary, except it's going to be totally digital. It'll have no moving parts, and it will be really expensive and very effective. But of course, that has happened. And I remember the looks on the faces that
sure.
I saw
oh, yeah.
from the executives in the room, and they're yeah. saying, well, that doesn't sound possible. It yeah. wasn't possible by what yeah. we knew at that time, except that if you had a little knowledge of digital electronics, you could begin to visualize what would happen.
Yeah.
And I made it my business to learn about that. My technical background, at the time I was in college, they didn't teach us anything about digital electronics. They knew about it, but yeah. they didn't teach us anything yeah. about it. But I had learned by just my own study. I think the thing that I'm getting at here, Jeff, is there's no excuse for personal, deep study and integration into the business in related and unrelated issues that will affect you, and like a unbelievable appetite for information that yeah. you get from reading different information and from knowing who to talk to, having friends that you trust in the business that will give you good advice,
yeah.
and having friends that have great business judgment. And with all of that, you get so well equipped that anytime you're called on to speak to a situation, you've yeah. got material off the cuff that you can deal with. And if you want to take time and write a message, you can do that and make it even better. But you're always equipped to speak
sure.
and to any situation because you've done your homework, you've studied, and you do it as a routine thing. It's not something that you, that's like heavy duty gun at your head type of thing.
Sure.
It's just something that you do because you love your business and you want it to prosper. You want it to be the expert that really knows everything that makes it work. And with those skills, you know, you're going to be hard to replace, and you also can make very great decisions and make great presentations about the direction of the business for the future.
Well, I think, and you know, what you're really showing and demonstrating in that explanation is that, you know, there's a commitment internally with you to spend the extra time to dive into things and do research to become more well-equipped and more informed on other things. And it's time, it's extra time away from your job that you're doing this, you're building, you know, you're building that skill set. And I mean, when I worked, my regional manager, Terry McManus, you know, asked me one day, do you want to make more money? Do you want to come better? I said, yes. And he said, I tell you what, read a business book a month. And Jeff, take three things at a minimum from each business book. And if you do that at the end of a year, you'll have 36 more arrows in your quiver to do business with. You'll be that much more informed if you just take three things from each book. And, you know, I did that for many, many years, and I call it third-party influence. I dipped into a lot of TPI. I learned a lot from reading about what other people did, but had I not invested in that personal attitude towards building my skills, I wouldn't have. So I'm leading up now to, you know, the fact that if you enter into sales, folks, if you take that and you look at it as a professional capacity of aspiration, not desperation, you walk this path we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes or so, you know, you're really starting to see that you're putting a tool belt on, and now you're putting all this assortment of professional tools in your tool belt. You've got this strapped on for the rest of your career, and you're walking into some high-powered jobs, some great situations, some wonderful economic earning power, because you're taking these skill sets that professional sales equips you with, and you can be better. My argument is you can do business better, quicker, faster, more effectively, and you can be more of an asset to companies down the road in your career because of the path you've taken. And I really want to just end. There's two more points I'd like to just really talk about. And before I end on one, is this, you know, strategic planning in sales today? And, you know, our good friend Steve Gilda obviously runs a sales training organization, grew up in Lanier. Yep. And, you know, strategic planning is a huge component of what they do, virtual planning and so forth. And talk a little bit about this. How did strategic planning at the sales level as you were growing up, how did that come into play as a leader down the road?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Jeff, because when I became CEO, national, what was that? Not CEO, but president of the company. I had this consultant that I worked with, and he came into office one day and he said, Wes, you're going to have to really learn about developing corporate strategy. And so I didn't know what in the world he's talking about. You know, I mean, I knew strategy, you know, it's kind of like to ask Casey Stengel, what's your strategy for winning ball games? And he said, hit it where they ain't. You know,
oh my goodness, a little bit of yogiism there, it looks like. Yeah,
exactly. I think Yogi knocked off Casey Stengel from some of his comments, but I had no idea what it was. And so, there was this consultant I worked with, was kind of we called him a kind of a guru, you know, and I talked to him a little bit about it. He said, well, look, Wes, he said, you know, you're entered into a new era of your leadership and strategy, and you're going to have to really understand it, manage it, use it, and you've got to know what it is. And he said, I've got a book I'm going to recommend to you, and you read that book and see what you think. So he sent me a book. It's called Top Management Strategy. It was written by two professors out of MIT. And I read the book, and it just blew my mind the way that they talked about analyzing the way that a company operated. And it seemed like that the things that strategy really dictates is like building a framework, if you will, around which big decisions are made. And the two big decisions are products for the future and markets for the future. And you're always looking, are we going to open new markets? Are we going to open new territories? And also you're always looking at what would be the products of the future that would really fit, that would beat the competition of the then marketplace. And this is all part of your strategic plan. And so building this framework around which decisions are made. So my job became to build within our company a framework around which these decisions were made. And that was my definition of corporate strategy, the framework around which market-driven decisions are made for the future of this company. And so I had to learn that. Now, the question is, what did I do when I found out I was in charge of corporate strategy? Did I throw up my hands, said, we'll hire an expert? What did I do? Well, I got busy and learned myself what it meant.
Yeah.
And then I was able to implement that thoroughly within the company. Of course, that mitigated itself into eventually being driven by the purpose, the corporate purpose of customer satisfaction. But that skills that I learned about developing corporate strategy, when it came to unifying those three companies that I had, the Lanier guys, the 3M guys, and the Harris guys.
Yeah.
If I hadn't put together that skill set, that would have been a crash on takeoff.
Yeah.
And what a beautiful, beautiful opportunity it was. And I learned so much in that process. It was, to me, and it really unlocked my future, my feeling about the business, because I'd never studied my college education. You know, I was I studied electronics. I didn't study anything about business. And everything I knew, I had learned through the School of Hard Knocks. And so that book was brilliant, and it opened up the door for me. And I gave copies of it to all my top men, and we had meetings where we discussed it, and we began to work out and dramatize various situations within our company. And we began to wrap our arms around. And also another thing that you found out in that process is which ones of your top executives are what you might call strategic and which ones are not. And there are some that are naturally strategic, or naturally is the right word. I wasn't naturally strategic. I was naturally interested in doing a good job. So I studied strategy. But there are guys who think strategically, and then there are guys who seem to be incapable of thinking strategically. And those are the ones you can't build on big time for the future.
Yeah.
So those are key things that you learn when you focus on strategy. So our friend Gilda's teaching, and I bet you he's getting a lot of companies who, when he goes into, they don't have a clue of what corporate strategy is all about, other than perhaps Casey Stengel's definition, hitting for the eight.
I think, again, it kind of stems from your personal commitment to investing your own personal and professional development. And here you are, you know, becoming more of a strategist. Yeah, but it's certainly, you know, in this day and age, you have to realize that there has to be a strategy laid out. You know, if you don't you know where you're going, any road will take you there, right? I mean, that's kind of a...
That's exactly right.
It's a basic strategy.
And you may remember, I think in one of our previous discussions, I mentioned that that professor at 3M, when I went to the development course up there, he taught us that all development is self-development.
Yes.
Well, see, I never forgot that. I said, look, I ain't got time to go back to Harvard and get an MBA or something like that. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to get the equivalent of an MBA even better by studying and learning how to do it.
Sure.
So it kind of reminds me of the time when I had this lady that I wanted to put into head of our HR department. Her name is Vera Author. All of the guys that watch this will know Vera. She's just a wonderful human being. But I was looking for a woman for our HR department. I hired a search firm, and they brought me two or three candidates. And all the candidates they brought me, I won't get into political definitions here. Let's just say that none of them could I have tolerated. And so I go home, and my wife said to me, Wes, have you considered putting Vera in that job? And I said, Vera? No, why would I put Vera in that job? She has no educational background for it and no experience. And my wife looked at me and she said, Wes, when you became CEO of Lanier, did you have an educational background for it? And I said, no. And she said, do you have any experience in it? And I said, no. Then she said, and what did you do? And I said, I learned real fast. And she said, put Vera in the job. She'll do the same thing. And, you know, we put Vera in the job and she did the same thing. Now, how did my wife know that? Well, I don't know. Yeah. This is a woman's intuition kind of thing. But even Vera knows that story. She may watch this. She's still alive and well with us today. And her appointment to HR, you know, one of the most difficult departments at companies is HR.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And they are nowadays, particularly with all the stuff going on in the modern world, I'm just glad I'm out.
Yeah.
I don't have to do that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's an awesome story. And, I think that, when we look at the whole ball of wax, of this profession we call selling, Wes, I want to end just our questions on this note. I mean, I have come to realize the significance of genuine enthusiasm. And I think if you talk to a lot of people who don't know anything about sales, they'll probably think that, you know, yeah, enthusiasm's a factor in it. But there's a lot of artificial enthusiasm. There's a lot of lack of enthusiasm. But when I read one time that Andrew Carnegie paid Charles Schwab $1 million salary in 1929 to run the U.S. Steel Corporation because he had a tangible ability to get people excited and this enthusiasm, it was a genuine thing, and it was contagious. And I spoke about it one time at a college. I was speaking on 4 points. I had about 85 people in the audience. And the 4 points, one of them was genuine enthusiasm. And the professor made the college students send me back a couple paragraphs of a analysis of my speaking event. So I got a 21-page report sent back to me. And I believe it ended up being 58 of those people ended up commenting about genuine enthusiasm. It was news to them. And every comment was positive. So let's end on that in the selling profession and in the leadership profession. Explain in your terms what genuine enthusiasm is and how important is it?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting that you bring that up at this pace point of my life here. As you pointed out, I'm 88 years old and I live in a senior living facility. I see how many people are in the way they go about their daily work. They are just sad. And they don't feel they have opportunity. And unfortunately, in some cases, you know, people, it's like they're just counting out how many more days they might have until they die. And it's a very, very sad thing. And I encounter that. And I think about what is the future here for those people? What can we do? How can we reach out and help them? And but one of the things that I have done here at Holbrook, where I live, is I have been a friend to everybody. They all know, of course, that they probably would ask if you ask them off the cuff, they'd say, well, we don't know about Wes. He's kind of religious, or something like that's probably what they'd say. But I have deep conversations with them. I like to pray for them and let them know that I'm praying for them. I take a personal interest in them. And, you know, the exciting thing about this stage of my life is, it's not the least bit discouraging if you know exactly where you're going. If you don't know where you're going, it can be pretty discouraging.
Sure.
You know, but if you know where you're going and you know the description of the place where you're going, and I know when I get there, I'm going to be with my wife, Bernadine, and my mother and daddy and my grandmother who live with us and I love. I mean, that vision of the future as contrasting to getting out of this world that I'm in today. And this world we're in today is not a comfortable place to live in. There's so much change and craziness going on that you wonder, can this continue? This is not the country I grew up in.
Right.
And it's headed toward becoming even worse. I don't quite understand that. So the answer is to have a real good firm fix on where you're going. The question I like to ask is, if you died tomorrow, do you know you'd go to heaven? And quite frequently, they say, well, I hope so. And my answer to that would be to say, well, would you like to know so? Not just to hope so, but to know so. And if they say yes, then I tell them the biblical procedure of receiving the Lord Jesus Christ and having him come into your life, and then you know where you're going.
Sure.
And the future prediction is glorious, beautiful, nothing but glory. So that's kind of what I'm living and doing right now. And that gives me a great sense of enthusiasm about life. And it also means that a lot of people around here are kind of glad to see me coming. Where in the past, someone look at me and say, well, that's that religious nut. You got to stay away from him. Something like that. And I've developed quite a list of friends here. And that same attitude would prevail in my business career if I was still working in the public place.
Absolutely.
To have a great idea of the future and hope for where everybody is going in business and in their personal life. and in their spiritual life. Spiritual life adds a completely new dimension to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And to me, it gives me a purpose for living and for continuing and to be here, and particularly being a good grandfather to my huge family of, you know, all the 70-something people, grandchildren included, just to say there is a wonderful future. To think about that in terms of business, yes, to say we got a great business here, there's a great future here for you. All you have to do is do what we require of you do and do the best for the customer that you possibly can in every situation, and it will put a big smile on your face, and you'll have a good retirement plan. And the best retirement plan is to know where you're going when you die, best of all. So that's kind of summarizes what I think about it right now. Maybe I've been retired for over 20 years, so I'm probably more thinking about living in a retirement center as contrasted to working every day.
Yeah. Well, you are you are genuinely enthusiastic about your beliefs and about the eternal life and about tomorrow. And I mean, you've taken a career, you've taken a profession in selling, you've taken a leadership, and you've been in big leadership capacities, and you've always been noted as being a very enthusiastic person. But this is spelling out genuine enthusiasm for the care of people more than any business could ever shine a light on genuine enthusiasm. So for that, I hope those people in Holbrook are very thankful. We're thankful. Obviously, God's thankful. And what a great cause to be living out right now, to be able to make people happy where you are, Wes. That's just awesome. And, it doesn't feel like I'm talking to an 88-year-old man here. It just doesn't. I don't know. Boy, I hope all your grandkids and great-grandkids have the same zest and vim and vigor and love for life that you do as well. So just if we could, just the two things. What advice – okay, there's a high school student listening, one of your grandchildren, great-grandchildren. There's a college graduate, soon-to-be college graduate. I don't know. There's tons of people that will listen to this. What advice could you give to somebody young who has not carved out a career yet? What could you say to them that would help them put whatever career they choose on the right cornerstone and do the right thing?
Well, you can't help but think today going to college, and I've helped many of my grandchildren go to college with their tuition expenses and so forth, to make the right decision about the kind of college you go to and what kind of course of study you're going to. And today it is so confusing to me to know what is the best thing to do in terms of education. It's just difficult. It's all very, very different. But I believe that the core education that really pays off today is technical. And so if you, I believe when I was growing up in the business, I believe the two pieces of paper I wish I had was a technical undergraduate degree. And I did have that, except my degree was an associate's degree, but I knew a lot about electronics, but I didn't know anything about digital electronics at all. That's where the marketplace was going, of course, rapidly.
Yeah.
But to have a master's in business administration, like a regular MBA.
Yeah.
Those two pieces of paper really kept you out of ticket into anything that you want to do. They give you the background of information that you need in order to be successful in just about any job. But in neither one of those professions are they going to teach you anything directly about salesmanship. But in the professional field, you're going to have opportunities to study and make presentations. And as you make those presentations, think of each one of those presentations as a sales pitch. In other words, you're showing somebody how a particular financial plan works, and you're going to sell them on the attributes of it and use your benefit, your selling skills to do that. That will be very important in the future, because if you're in business and you're putting together a financial plan, there's going to be somebody like the CEO or the board of directors that wants to hear from you and how effectively you produce that. And so that's where the sales ability is going to come in every bit of this. Or let's just say that you've got an idea about a digital product for the future. This goes back in my own mind, thinking about the first time I conceived about digital electronics and how it could affect the dictating business, particularly the healthcare, the medical records departments. And when I began to understand how it could work in my own mind, and keep in mind that my background did not include technical,
sure.
It did not include digital, it was all analog. And so, but I went to an IBM school where we're getting a new computer, and they explained to us how this thing worked. My mind went crazy understanding digital electronics. And I didn't understand it completely, but I got enough of it that Bernadine would tell you that I stayed up all night drawing flow charts about a product for the future. Then I got this idea. So I go in and talk with the head of our engineering department, and those of the guys in the engineering would remember Nicky Bolick, who was the guy who headed that up. And I went and told him what I had in mind. And he said, well, Wes, you realize that that's a product like that would cost a lot to develop. And a product like that would, the sales force would really have to be equipped to explain how it works. And have you considered all that? And I said, yes. And he said, well, what are you thinking? I said, I think if we don't do it, we'll be out of business very soon. In just about 2 or 3 years, we're gone. We got to have this product because it's going to be the future.
Yeah.
So he hired then a couple of engineers from Georgia Tech to come over and help us with product design. And they designed the product. And at that time, the cost of various devices like memories, disk storage, and everything was so expensive that the cost of the equipment for a typical hospital installation was going to be like $200,000 or $300,000. So he asked me, he said, Wes, this thing's going to sell for $200,000 or $300,000. You've been selling these things for $30,000 to $40,000 a clip. Do you think you can sell one for $300,000? And I said, I sure would like to have a shot at it. And so long story short, we developed the system, and we were the first with a digital medical record system in the marketplace. Yeah. And we swept the market and just did beautifully with it. And all of that, now, that's a combination of putting together knowledge and salesmanship. I had to sell Nicky on, I mean, he worked for me kind of, but you know, Nicky, if you knew him, he didn't work for anybody.
Yeah.
He was a kind of a genius kind of a guy.
Yeah.
And I had to win that argument with him. Like when he said, but Wes, do you think you sell any of those? I said, well, no, but I sure want to try. And I said to him, look, we either got to do this or somebody's going to do it. We're going to be out of business. Now, that's the decision that somebody should have had with Sears and Roebuck that we talked about earlier. Yeah. And that didn't happen there. I don't know why. And I'd love to have been a fly on the wall in that board of directors to see when they decided not to go into the web-based business. And they had everything in place.
Yeah.
Everything. Could have done it with a flick of a coin almost.
Well, very.
It's one of the mysteries of life.
Yeah, anyway, it definitely is, for sure. What happened to Sears Roebuck? Well, you know, my wife just told me yesterday that she goes, did you know that Sears Roebuck used to have a kit to build your own home? You could actually buy a kit to build your own home. I don't know what it cost or what year this was, but you know, it is an interesting company to look back on, and probably plenty to learn from that. You know, speaking of the digital transformation that you took us through back then, I actually took American International Group down to Philadelphia from New York City to see a law firm that had one of these digital central systems installed there, and you know, another thing that we didn't talk about today is creativity. You get to be a little creative in sales too. So we were like, well, what do we do? Who's going to drive? What kind of limo? Is it a limo? Is it a train? What do we do? So we got it. One of my sales manager got an unemployed friend, had him put on his suit. We rented a Grand Marquis and we drove this executive down to Philly, in a makeshift limo. And we were very fortunate. We actually got a head start on things because the proposal for a central system from our competitors on the front cover, the gentleman from American International Group showed me, it was American International Group. They forgot to put the E in the word American on the front cover. Ooh. So I was starting off on a good foot right away. And actually, I'm still friends to this day with that executive. And that's from 1986, and I've actually interviewed his son on our podcast, which she was autistic. So kind of fun. You know, there is some talk about a good name. You know, I've been able to keep that good name with him anyways. And so very, very important. So, Wes, as we kind of close in here, I do want to just mention to folks, I'm almost done with this book. But High Performance Ethics, as you call it, HPE, great book. I read your first book, or you read your other book a couple months ago, and great book, by the way. If anyone wants to get it, we're going to put links up to the books. A lot of great stuff in there. But, Wes, right now, you're kind of on a speaking topic, and you're on a topic that you're out and about talking to church groups and associations about, and it's called tipping points. Would love you just to explain, because everyone encounters tipping points, and they're, you know, if they don't know what they are, I'd like you to explain them, and if you could, and give an example of one, if you could.
Okay, I'd love to do that. It's a hot subject for me right now, because it comes up in my mind going back and reviewing major decisions that I had to make and what the effect was. And a tipping point is that you have a decision to make. And a lot of decisions have out long range, all kinds of things that happen as a result of that decision that you don't anticipate. So we're saying a failure to understand and forecast the long range effect of a decision, what negative effects or positive effects it might have in the future. And so I recently made this presentation to a group of men here at our church, and they said, well, Wes, how do you determine when a decision might be a tipping point? And my answer was, I would suggest that you investigate every decision as a tipping point, and then ask the Lord to reveal to you if it is, and ask the Lord to give you the answer, because he will provide through you an answer to your prayer. And if you ask him to help you on that, he will give you foresight, which is a wonderful thing to have. Perhaps the greatest gift that any executive have is foresight, the ability to look into the future and see what's coming.
Yeah.
The tipping point is when you don't look into the future, but you just flippantly make the decision and you go with whatever happens. Now, when I was talking about tipping points in my career, I talked about when I went to work for Lanier, first thing that happened is, you know, the boss called me in and they told me to clean the boss's fishing tackle. And you remember that story?
Sure.
Now, I see that as a tipping point. I think had I refused and gone ahead and left the company and gone with the other company or whatever and said, I'm not here to clean fishing tackle. I'm a technician. I know electronics and this is insulting. Sure. And I could have walked out. I had all those thoughts, but my thoughts centered back on obeying the boss. Yeah. And so that's what I did. And I think that paid off handsomely for me in the future with Ms. Lanier. I think he always remembered that and he gave me high marks. So that's one tipping point. Perhaps the next tipping point that was most critical is the same guy calls me into his office and says, Cantrell, how soon can you be in Baton Rouge, Louisiana? And I said, I don't know where it is, but I'll go. I'll be there as soon as you want me to be there. And he said, that's the right answer. You go, but I'm thinking all the time, I don't want to go. And why should I leave to go to Baton Rouge? I had never been there before. Yeah. And besides living here at home, I'm still living with my parents. My mother's cooking for me and washing clothes for me. You know, I've got a smoking hot girlfriend. I've got this job offer from IBM. You know, all I got to do is just call IBM and say, I'm going with you. It's a month out, but I can wait a month. And I'll be with IBM. So I had all those thoughts. And so I went home and talked to my daddy about it. And my daddy, God bless him, he said, son, if you're going to amount to anything, you go where that company sends you. That's all he said. We didn't talk about anything else. About IBM, nothing. About the job. He was not. My daddy was a school teacher and a minister. So he didn't understand the difference between IBM and Lanier, which was like, IBM at that time was a $1 billion company and Lanier was $3 million.
Wow.
So I decided on his advice to go to Baton Rouge. Well, you know what happened? In Baton Rouge, I met this girl. Her name was Bernadine. Everybody knows me, knows about her. And she was just a country girl, like I was a country boy. And we hit it off together. We got married, started producing children. She was a great, great supporter for everything I did. Very smart, very enthusiastic. She was a right arm to me. Well, that was another tipping point. If I'd have stayed up here, gone with IBM, and I probably would have married the little girl I was dating up here, which, you know,
right.
I don't know the details about that. I just know that the finding Bernadine
sure.
was very critical for my future. That's just a couple that I think of, but there are many, many others that I could think of in my career.
Yeah.
So my advice to anybody facing any decision is to say, well, could this be a tipping point?
Yeah.
In other words, look over the horizon and say,
yeah.
what's coming? Mm-hmm. If I do this, like, for example, the men asked me, what would you say would be a big example of tipping points? I'd say, well, two I can think of right now is, let's say you graduate high school and you got a girlfriend. Do you marry this girl? Or you know, what should you do? Can you decide how would be the basis of deciding if you want to marry her? Because let me tell you that whoever you marry has unpredictable, long-range things that are going to come up. And so the ability that you have to understand that now will keep you from making a bad decision. We also said another one is what college you go to. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier. What kind of equipment, what kind of education do you need? So those are a couple of illustrations of tipping points, but there are many of those. And the wisest executives are the ones who have an amazing sense of being able to foretell the future. They're like they've got a distant early warning system radar that goes out over the horizon and sees what's coming and prepares their company for it in advance. If you can do that, that is brilliance. And then that is the kind of leadership that you can't just buy off the street. And as we see from some of the examples we've used here today, not everybody's got that. That's not a free gift that you just get by staying alive. It comes from study. And I believe it really comes from having a relationship with the Lord where he reveals to you things that you need to know. He will do that. He does that. He loves to do that.
Yeah.
And when you're obeying him and you're submitted to him, he will do that and give you this divine foresight that you need in order to do what you need to adjust you for the future. That would be my key message to all those who are watching us.
Well, and thank you so much. And I think, Wes, really, when you think about the essence and why, you know, I asked you to do this podcast with me, is that if there are any chin rubbers, there are any young people that haven't thought about what direction they're going to go, they're at a fork in the road, right? And the fork wise out. So maybe, just maybe, this podcast is the tipping point where they say, you know what? I thought I was going to go this way. I'm actually going to go to the left instead of the right. I'm going to go down the path of being a professional salesperson. And I think if you go into it with that attitude that you are going to be a professional person, you're going to eventually, that's going to be your tipping point moment that you will build a tool belt and you will equip that tool belt. You will put individual tools in those slots, in those holster areas, those, you know, scabbard areas on that tool belt, so that when you're done, you've got a fantastic set of tools to help you really maximize your earning potential in the latter part of your career, make an impact in companies, make an impact in industries, and make an impact in the world. And wouldn't it be a great place if our leaders of today were evangelists of truth 20 years ago?
Oh,
right?
Man.
You know, we see way too many lies right now, and we wish we did have more. Yeah, there you go, evangelists of truth out there in leadership, and it's really evident.
We need to take a carload of these
bugs
down to Washington, D.C. and sell them.
they might throw them at me. Like, you know, Antifa can't get bricks, they'll throw those at me, you know. But so at any rate, in closing, I just want to say we always ask, and we have a lot of fun with this, but we ask, if there's a song that's important to you now in your life, if there's something that really resonates with you. And I asked you prior to the show and you gave me just a wonderful answer. So what is your special song that we'll end with today, and who is the performer you want us to feature singing it?
Well, the special song is Touch Through Me. It's a beautiful song that has to do with asking the Lord to reach out to other people through you. It means that you're using your life as being an instrument to influence and to help other people find their way and answers to their problems. And it is so beautiful to me because here at Holbrook, there is so much necessity to reaching out to others. There are a lot of sad people who are here. They aren't happy. They just need a special touch. And so the song Touch Through Me is a very good song. Now, my favorite artist on that song is a lady named Babs Hawks. And Babs sings it, and maybe Jeff will be able to play it for you some way. I don't know. We've got all the electronics available, but I sent him a copy of her singing that song. And it's a beautiful, beautiful song. It's all over Facebook. Different people are singing it, but it's a beautiful song and has a great, great message. It just says, the Holy Spirit, touch through me. Others, there are lots of hurting people out there. They need help. Touch through me. It means I'm available to be your instrument to touch other people. What a beautiful song, particularly for this particular phase of my life. It's a perfect illustration of where I find myself and what I want to do today. Well, so that's the song.
Well, I tell you what, folks, we will have, if nothing else, the link to the song and the link to Babs Hawks singing it as well. We've got some time before this airs, Wes, so we'll try to figure something out. But nonetheless, we'll have the link there for sure to that recording. We'll also have the links to both of Wes's books. And, I just want to end by saying, on behalf of the whole entire Lanier Business Products, Lanier Worldwide, Rico Copier community, it is a pleasure knowing you. I am certainly a better man for knowing you. I appreciate Rick, Diana, brokering all this together with us. What a wonderful individual and great professional he is. And he's been on this show a couple times and just a dear friend now. And I just know that there's so many of us, Wes, let's say thank you for your leadership. Thank you to be somebody that we could aspire to be like in our life. And mostly, I hope that your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren enjoy this for years and decades to come and get to see what their, a special person in their life, Wesley E. Cantrell, is all about, because you laid it on the line today, sir, and we appreciate it. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much for everything you've done.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a great day.
It is a great day. And we will see you. My pleasure. We will see you in the future. And folks, we will be back next week in 168 hours. So be sure to tune in. And we love you, Wes. Thank you so much. And we will look forward to seeing you in the future.
Right, Jeff.
Take care, everybody.
It'll be a pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.